I always forget about that.
Okay, so for the first hour, I'm going to cover ethics. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to cover ethical decisions as a Christian, so or as a theist. So if you're coming from a perspective that there is a universal moral law, that's great. But unfortunately, sometimes those decisions conflict. So we're going to talk a little bit about that, but then I'm also going to briefly touch on secular moral systems, just so we can kind of get an idea of the difference between them. So this is called Scripture as God's Precedent for Choosing the Greater Good When Faced with Conflicting Absolutes. It's a very long title, but basically what it means is that the Bible is going to be our guide when it comes to making ethical decisions. And obviously with the Bible, we always want to make sure we take it in context, so we're going to talk about how you find the context of a particular ethical passage and how you know if a passage is meant to be a moral lesson or not. So how many of you guys know who Corrie Ten Boom is? Most people know who she is. If you don't, she's a young Christian woman during World War II. She hid Jews in her home, as well as helped others escape through the Dutch underground network. When one reads her autobiography, The Hiding Place, and realizes that Corrie and her family were Christian, obviously the age-old question of moral dilemma comes to mind. As a Christian, is it permissible to lie, as Corrie did when the Gestapo came looking for the Jews she was hiding? Or do you tell the truth in all cases because lying's a sin? So that's what St. Augustine would say. He'd say, you should never lie, you should always tell the truth, even if it means an innocent life will be lost. And we'll talk more about that in a second. This particular dilemma is what is known as conflicting absolutes. When a Christian or an absolutist is faced with two decisions or two choices that conflict, you have to wonder what's the right course of action. In the next hour, we'll make the case that there is indeed a specific course for Christians to take and that has been laid out in Scripture. So, again, we're going to focus specifically on absolutism. So we all kind of know the moral law case for the moral lawgiver, that a universal moral law means a moral lawgiver. There is a universal moral law, therefore there's a universal moral lawgiver. Absolute morality is considered a prescriptive duty, meaning that if we have a God and he has an absolute moral law, it's something you are prescribed to do. It's an action that you have to take. There is no option for inaction. You have to make some type of decision. And so we have to figure out what decision we should make. So it means what one ought to do in an ethical dilemma. So absolutes are obviously objective, eternal, and universal, binding on all persons at all times in all places. And this belief is consistent with the theistic worldview because for absolutes to be universal, they have to have come from a universal source. Josh McDowell writes, "It is impossible to arrive at an objective, universal, and constant standard for truth and morality without bringing God onto the stage. If an objective standard of truth and morality exists, it cannot be the product of a human mind or it won't be objective. So it must be the product of another mind." C.S. Lewis writes in The Abolition of Man, basically, he gives a large list of laws that are similar across the world. All these different tribes, people that have never had contact with each other, have these same laws. Well, why would that be unless there's somebody who gave them those laws originally? So this is kind of be what we're going to focus on, that we're going to assume that there is a universal moral law. So what are the alternatives to absolutism? If you're not a Christian, you're probably going to pick some of these different options. So different belief systems choose different approaches depending on what their ideology is. So for an example, in atheism, evolutionary theory states that self-preservation is man's automatic first response, or ethics based on ego. So if it's survival of the fittest, you're going to choose yourself to survive. So you're going to do everything you can to make sure that happens, which means you put yourself first. This would be the opposite of Christian morality, because morals require that we do the right thing in a given situation. So if we're in a situation where we have choices, we have to do the right thing, not necessarily what's best for us to survive. So that's the difference between the two. Often the right thing for a Christian results in self-sacrifice, which is contradictory to the evolutionary worldview of survival of the fittest. Imagine if Jesus Christ was like, oh, I'm an evolutionist and I believe in survival of the fittest. Well, I highly doubt he would have gone to the cross for us. So sacrifice and putting other people first is the opposite of an evolutionary worldview, but it's the Christian ethic that we should choose. So that's the first choice. And then we'll go into the other ones in a second. But if an atheist was hiding the Jews and told by the Gestapo that he would be rewarded instead of punished if he revealed them, if he was consistent with his beliefs, he'd have to give up the Jews. But most people know this isn't right or moral, and ethics simply cannot exist in an evolutionary worldview without stealing from theism. So most atheists, if you would ask them the question, if Hitler came to your door and said, I'll give you a reward if you give up Jews, most atheists would probably still say, no, I'd lie, and I'd help the Jews, because they're with the innocent party in this whole thing. And what Hitler was doing is evil. But they can't make those assertions without borrowing from Christianity or the theistic worldview. Yet, most moral atheists would do that in the situation. But if it was up to their evolutionary worldview, they should go for the reward, as opposed to saving the Jews. So most of them live inconsistently. The second option is the categorical imperative. This is Immanuel Kant. He said, live your life as though your every act were to become moral law. So he says the right thing to do is what you could will everyone to do under the same circumstance. So meaning it has to be able to be universalized. So when you have to make a decision, your decision should be based on, would I want everyone in the world to make this decision? And if so, great. If not, then I can't do it. He doesn't look at things as like a case-by-case basis. Everything has to be, it applies to everybody. So, for example, no one should lie, because if lying was universal, there'd be no more truth to lie about. And then lying would become impossible. Same goes for killing. You shouldn't kill, because if everybody did it, then there'd be nobody left. So he looks at the consequences of what will happen if everybody does this. So that's the choice of categorical imperative. If an action would not work universally, Kant would determine it's the wrong one. Problem is, the categorical imperative is subjective, right, to the person, because the reasoning of the human being is the deciding factor on whether or not a specific action should be universalized, and every human being comes to an ethical dilemma with different backgrounds. So even though you're saying, should the whole world do this, it's your idea what should or ought would be. So you're imposing your idea of what everyone should do on the rest of the world. So it's still subjective, because it's based on a person's opinion. It's one person's opinion that lying should not become universal. You know, and I mean, I agree with it, but still, it's subjective, and it needs to be a case-by-case basis if you did this. The last option is moral relativism. And online, there's lots of funny memes about it, because it's a little bit ridiculous. It's self-defeating, because it's an absolute in itself, yet it denies absolutism. So this one, guys are arguing, they're like, well, if there's no truth, then why are you arguing? If there's no absolute truth to lean on, then you can't really argue your case, because you could both be right, right? Because moral relativism says that you're both right. So there's no point in having any type of argument or debate. And then, is relativism relative? No, it's an absolute belief. You believe that everybody should be a relativist. Therefore, it's an absolute statement. So it's self-defeating. And then, there's one of Dawkins. It says, I'm against dangerous ideas, but I love moral relativism. And because moral relativism is an idea in itself, and it's, he's being self-defeating. There's no way to deny absolutes without utilizing an absolute. When someone insists that no absolutes exist, he or she unwittingly admits to at least one. In reality, there is no way to avoid them. So C.S. Lewis says, people say things like, how'd you like it if anyone did the same to you? Or, come on, you promised, every day. He observes that the man who makes these statements is not merely saying that the other man's behavior does not happen to please him. He's appealing to some kind of standard of behavior which he expects the other man to know about. So if someone does something and you say, hey, that's not fair, well, you're appealing to a standard that you hope the other person agrees with, right? Otherwise, it doesn't matter if it's fair or just, or you think it's right, because the other person could hold a different worldview than you. So you can't claim things like that, especially if you're a relativist. So we know that the atheistic worldview is inconsistent. The categorical comparative really doesn't work because it's subjective to a person's opinion. And then the moral relativism is it's verbal suicide. It's just illogical. So those three systems don't really work in the world we live in today. So therefore, we have to go with absolutism, which is why we're focusing on that one. Of course, just like everything in Christianity, even if we're both Christians or theists, we still have things we disagree with under that umbrella, right? So we've got two different guys who disagree about how things, how you make these choices. So you have St. Augustine and Thomas Aquinas. So when you're dealing with two ethical choices under absolutism, the first idea you could have is called unqualified absolutism. This theory was first offered by Augustine. Its basic premise is all moral conflicts are only apparent. They are not real. Sin is always avoidable. There are moral absolutes that admit of no exceptions, and these never actually come into conflict with one another. Should one ever lie to save a life? No. So he says, even if one does not lie to save a life, you'll not be held responsible if a death should result at the hands of another. So Augustine says, these things don't exist. There's never a conflict. And you shouldn't lie to save a life because if you tell the truth, you're not responsible for what happens as a result, right? Aquinas also believed in this, but he had a different view. He believed, like Augustine, lying is never okay, but not just because lying's a sin. He said that the apparent moral dilemma resulted from a lack of knowledge of a third alternative. So he's basically saying, not that you should never lie because it's a sin, but you should not lie because you're not imaginative enough to think of a third alternative, a third door. So if your choice is lie to save a life or tell the truth and have someone die, he's saying you just don't have enough knowledge to know that there's another window out there somewhere with an option that you don't know about, and you're not held responsible for not knowing that decision. Problem is, a third alternative is not always guaranteed. Geisler states that it's both unrealistic and unbiblical to assume that moral obligations never conflict. And he basically gives the example of a tubal pregnancy. There's two choices, right? You terminate the pregnancy, or you hope for the best and potentially the mother and the baby die. But you have to make a choice in some way. There's two options. Either you operate or you don't operate. And so there are some cases where there are only two options. So for Aquinas to say, oh, there's always a third alternative, there's not always a third alternative. Bonhoeffer states, the man with a conscience fights a lonely battle against the overwhelming forces of inescapable situations which demand decisions. So we are put in these places where we have to make decisions, and we don't have a choice to get out of it. So some Christians will say, well, a third alternative will eventually present itself, and if you just wait long enough and hope for a miracle, God will come through, right? However, we can't just sit back and hope that God intervenes, because it's not that he can't or won't. It just might be a reason why he doesn't. And we have to make the decision with the information that we have, with the faculties that he gave us. So we are never to test God, Matthew 4:7. And like I was saying, there may be a reason or purpose behind the dilemma, and God gives us the needed faculties we have to make a decision when necessary. So do absolutes conflict? Yes, they do. And you have to make a decision. You can't just wait or hope for a third alternative to show up. So what do you do when that happens? Well, there are two views under conflicting absolutism, which we'll talk about. The first is the lesser evil view, right? Like Augustine and Aquinas, both courses of action are evil. So whether you lie or whether you tell the truth, both options are bad, right? Because you're either sinning or someone else is going to die. So for them, both courses of action are evil, so therefore they try to avoid the situation, right? However, it's better to have the lesser of two evils and trust that God's forgiveness is there having to complete it. So this is what the lesser evil view is that you know that both are bad, but you make the less bad one. You make the less. So if you're like, okay, do I lie or do I tell the truth or have someone die? Well, they're both wrong, but which one's less evil? And that's how you make your decision. But problem is, God would not punish somebody for making a decision that was unavoidable. So, because that's just not what a just God would do. So he wouldn't put you in a situation and say, make a decision, and then have both decisions be wrong, because then what? If you sin, because both decisions are wrong, it's unavoidable, which means you get judged for that sin, right? So God would not put you in that situation. So some people say, well, it's better to ask forgiveness than permission, right? No matter which decision you choose, you'll sin. And so should we just make it and hope that God forgives us in the long run? That's also kind of inconsistent with the nature of God, because, like I said, he would not put us in a situation where it's unavoidable to sin. So a person's only guilty if the action's avoidable. So if you have a choice, a free will choice in the matter, then you're only guilty if you were able to avoid the evil and you chose not to. So basically, the author, actually, me, I just talked about myself in the third person. What about, my question is always when I get asked this, what about missionaries that smuggle Bibles into other countries? They're doing something wrong, right? But they're doing it for a good reason. But, you know, how do we deal with that? So there's a deception taking place, yet they're following Jesus' commandment to go and make disciples. So can one really say that it's wrong to attempt to bring the gospel and eternal life simply because there's a matter of lying involved? Proverbs 3:27 states, when it is in your power, do not withhold good from the one whom it's due. So the thing is, people are like, oh, well, that's not the same because the action's avoidable. They could just not do that. They could just not bring Bibles into the other country, you know, because they have a choice here. It's not like the two-will pregnancy where you have two bad choices. You could avoid this one. But the problem is that they can't really, because they're following God's commands, right? They're trying to be obedient to the Creator to bring the eternal life into another country. So really, it's not avoidable because they're following their mandate, but it kind of is. And so this is why the lesser evil view is a little bit convoluted. It's a little bit hard to decide what is actually the right action here. And I think that's the problem with this view, is that it's too hard to figure out which one's the right one. And in that view, neither one are actually right. They're both sins still. They're both evil. One's just a little less evil. So we're going to talk about that more in a second. But lying does not always equal deception. So Paul Copen says, all lying is deception, but not all deception is lying. Lying involves a breaking of trust only when we have a duty to tell the truth. If some deceptions can be seen as worthy, then it does not follow that they should be counted as sins in need of forgiveness. So this is why he says a lesser evil view isn't good, because both can't be sins if lying is not always a sin. And so in some situations, lying is not a sin, because you're not lying to be evil. You're deceiving, or you're lying in order to bring about goodness. And so it's basically, there's one thing back here I wanted to say, but I can't remember. So the question is, which we'll get more of this in a second, with the missionaries, they lie to bring the Bibles into the other country, but who are they deceiving? The person that they're deceiving is what? An unholy government, right? So the question, I think really the question is, when you're deceiving somebody, who are you deceiving, and do they deserve the truth? And so he makes that distinction. He says it's only lying's only a sin if you're lying to somebody who deserves the truth. Otherwise, you're excused from having to tell the truth. And we'll talk more about that in a second. But Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who knows this really well, because he was in Hitler's administration during World War II, but he was a Christian, and he was trying to free the Jews. He was trying to give them papers to be able to flee. And he says, if it's now asserted that a lie is a deliberate deception of another man to his detriment, then this would also include the necessary deception of the enemy in war or similar situations. If this sort of conduct is called lying, the lie thereby acquires moral sanction and justification, which conflicts in every possible way with the accepted meaning of the term. Basically, he's saying every lie cannot be wrong because people do it in war. And it's justified in war when you deceive the enemy to bring about your ends, right? Because the other side, let's say in your opinion, is the evil side. And so therefore you should not be required to be truthful with them. And so he says there's got to be another way to classify a morally permissible deception. So the difference is, is that some lies are morally permissible deceptions. And in that case, if they're morally permissible, this isn't the lesser evil view, because they're not both wrong. Both choices aren't wrong. So let's say the choice is to lie or truth. Both of these are wrong because if the truth leads to death, those are both sins, right? But you have to pick the lesser evil. But we can avoid this conflict of them both being sins by saying, well, sometimes this isn't a sin in some situations. Sometimes it's a morally permissible thing that you do. And we'll talk about how that fits into the actual view that I think we should take. So McDowell says, lying is always wrong as such and never justifiable or right in itself. We are exempt from obedience to the law against lying only when it's preempted by a greater obligation. When telling the truth endangers innocent lives, the greater good is to preserve innocent lives. It is important to note that lying in this context is not an exception, but merely a temporary exemption based on scriptural priority of the greater good. Value principle is this: innocent persons are more worthy of loving respect than persons who promote non-loving activity. So the Jews who are innocent deserve more love than those who are coming knocking at the door that want to kill them. So because of that, instead of this being the wrong thing to do, it becomes the right thing to do, and the idea of it being a sin is gone. Because you're living in light of a greater good. So now people are like, okay, well, in this greater good view, how do you know what the greatest good is in a given situation? And so we have a hierarchy that's given us. In graded absolutism, the first person you have to obey is God, the second person is people, and the third thing is things or material objects. So God makes us stewards of our stuff, so we do have to include material things somewhere on the list, but they are not as important as other people, and they are not as important as God. So in a situation when you have to make a choice like that, you would say, okay, what is my greatest obligation to? My greatest obligation is to God. Let's say someone puts a gun to your head. How do you decide between these two? Well, someone puts a gun to your head and says, someone puts a gun to somebody else's head and says, deny that you're a Christian or deny God or I'm going to blow this person's head off. In this hierarchy, what do? You can't deny God, right? You have to obey him, and so you just have to trust that he's got it under control and obey him. And so that's what I mean by saying that these decisions are hard, but there is a clear choice if you understand the hierarchy given in Scripture. So this is what's known as, again, like the greater good. It's also called graded absolutism, because there are grades or levels given to specific things.
Sure.
Yeah.
I recently saw a movie, Martin Scorsese's movie, where the missionaries go over to the Philippines.
Silence.
Philippines, I think it is.
Yeah, I think it's Silence.
Yeah. And they have to make the decision. I don't know if you're aware of this.
Yeah.
They're either going to deface God,
right,
and deny, or if they deny, they're going to save a lot of people from dying. And I think what he actually does, what the missionaries decide to do, is they deny God, they save all these people, but in the very end of the movie, you can see the person holding the cross in his hand, the missionary, before he dies. So in his heart, he didn't deny, but he saved these people. Now, is that right, given what you have here?
Well, actually, I'm glad you said that. That's a great movie, a great example of that.
Silence.
It's a great example, and you know, it's hard because what does he say? If you deny me before men, I'll deny you before my Father in heaven. And so when it comes down to that, I would say, you know, yeah, you can ask for forgiveness, but how do you know? Like, how do you know that he's going to like, you just don't know. And so actually we're going to see there's some examples in scripture of people making decisions like that. Okay. So in this view, if you're given a situation where you lie or tell the truth under greater good, instead of both of these being wrong, one becomes actually the right thing to do. And that's where you get this. So in this situation, lying is not the lesser evil. Lying is not the choice you make because sin's unavoidable. Lying is the choice you make because it's the right thing to do in the situation. And you're actually exempted. It's a temporary exemption from the law because that lie is not a lie for evil, but it's a morally permissible deception because you're dealing with an unholy person that doesn't deserve the truth. And so we'll see examples of that in Scripture. So in Scripture, we see that there are grades or levels in lots of different areas. In Matthew 10:37, guess what? You have to love God before your family, right? Because he says, if you love your earthly family more than God, you're not worthy of him. Now, does it actually mean that Jesus wants us to hate our families? No, that's not what he's saying. He's just saying that, in contrast, God comes first. Man's vertical responsibility to love God comes before his horizontal responsibility to love his neighbors. Jesus also taught about the least and the greatest. He teaches that there that should be weightier matters, things that are more important than others. He says there is a greater sin, which means what? There are lesser sins, right? Degrees of punishment and reward, so different types of rewards and punishments for different types of things that you do, and varying degrees of discipline in church matters. So when Paul writes the churches, he doesn't give them the same punishment or discipline for every single action that happens. He gives them different ways for dealing with different issues. In some issues, he's like, kick the guy out of the church. And other times, he's like, embrace your brother and bring him back. And, you know, and he talks about different ways of dealing with discipline. So because of this, we know that he doesn't look at every moral action as the same or every immoral action as the same. And people are always like, oh, well, you know, then why is everybody kind of destined to hell if they deny God, if that's the case? And so what I'm going to get into later is your going to hell is not a result of a string of sins that you do. Going to hell is because of your choice to deny Jesus. And so people are like, why would you go to hell if you're a good person, but you made a few mistakes? Because you're not going because you made a few mistakes. You're going because you denied God. And so that's the difference. Because people are like, oh, if I'm a good person but I do a couple things wrong, then I should only be punished for those things. Kind of like purgatory. But that's not why we go to hell. We go to hell because we deny God. So if the Bible commands it, how do you do the greater good when it's against the law, right? So what if you're in a situation where the greatest good is against the law? For example, in Nazi Germany, if the Nazis come to your door and say, hey, we're the Jews, and you have to make a decision, what's the choice? The choice is obviously the greatest good, but how do you deal with that when the greatest good is against the law, which means saving the Jews is against the Germany's law at the time? So that's where you come into civil disobedience. Civil disobedience is a huge aspect of graded absolutism. It's the refusal to obey certain laws or governmental demands for the purpose of influencing legislation or government policy. But it's supposed to be nonviolent, right? Because God never calls us to have violence. And civil disobedience is kind of most evident in cases like World War II, like Corrie ten Boom, or the Underground Railroad of the Civil War, right? Where you had people who were helping the slaves escape, but guess what? That was against Southern law. If you found an escaped slave, what? You had to return them to their owner in the South. But most people didn't do that because they believed that they should obey God, which says men are not supposed to be treated like that. So most often, the greatest good is a decision to refuse to obey a corrupt government, and you basically accept any punishment that comes along with that. So, for example, when Rosa Parks was like, nope, I'm sitting, she knew she was going to go to jail, and she went. And Martin Luther King Jr., he knew that he was going to go to jail, and he went. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he knew that even though even though I'm saluting Hitler on the outside, on the inside I'm working against him. But he knew the punishment was going to be a concentration camp, and he accepted it. And so even though it's the right thing to do, we have to be willing to accept the worldly punishment that comes along with it. It says, must the citizen forever a moment or in the least degree resign his conscience to the legislator? Why does every man have a conscience then? I think that we should be men first and subjects afterward. So that's Thoreau, and it's in his famous essay on civil disobedience. And basically he's saying, look, you're a person with a moral code first, and then you're a subject of your government after. So you have to make a decision based on your moral code as opposed to what's the law. And so he's saying, you know, you follow God first, or you follow your conscience first, and then after that you decide, okay, does this mean I can obey the law, or do I have to disobey it? In their book, Ethics for a Brave New World, the Feinbergs write about civil disobedience from a moral view. They say what drives one to commit an act of civil disobedience is a decision based on the following process. A moral decision or judgment that a law or activity is unjust. After normal channels of addressing the injustice have proven fruitless, or the moral objections to this injustice of the law outweigh the moral reasons in favor of obedience. So these are only the times that you engage in civil disobedience. So it's not like you're just like, oh, I just want to disobey just because I don't feel like following the law. Well, that's not what civil disobedience is. Civil disobedience is a reaction to after you have gone through the proper channels, after you've made the proper advances to try to change things. If you can't change things, then you have to go through this list. Those who engage in civil disobedience have no legal right to break the law, but they claim a moral justification. Since they have no legal right to break the law, they should expect to be punished. However, by way of assessment, we think on some occasions civil disobedience is not only morally permissible, but even obligatory. So there are some cases where we are required by God to disobey the law. What would be an example of that? What if we were told we weren't allowed to pray, or we couldn't go to church, or we couldn't preach about Jesus, or, I mean, what if you can't be a Christian anymore? That's against the law. I mean, those situations, it would actually be the right thing to do to disobey. And that's where it comes from, the greater good, right? We obey God rather than men. So civil disobedience is basically just the process that you go through when you have to make a decision where God comes before men. Okay, civil disobedience obviously led to the civil rights movement. Rosa Parks, again, we talked about before, she was just like, nope, I'm not getting up. And they worked really hard and spent a lot of years trying to make this happen. It was mostly nonviolent, unless you're on the side of Malcolm X. They eventually, a law passed in 1963 that required public places to admit customers regardless of race. And so it just goes to show you that it does work, civil disobedience, in some cases, but you just have to be persistent, right? You can't just change a law by trying once and then giving up. Besides secular sources, a few biblical passages speak of the phenomenon of civil disobedience. Romans chapter 13 specifically says, you have to be obedient to the government because God is the one who put them in authority. However, then in Acts chapter 5, after being arrested for preaching the gospel, Peter and the apostles declare that they must obey God rather than human beings. This shows that any submission to authorities must pass through the filter of God's will and call upon a believer's life. You have to be men first and subjects second. Geisler and McDowell compare this exemption God offers to a jetliner taking off. He says, when a jetliner takes off, placing the laws of aerodynamics and gravity into conflict, as it lifts off, the aircraft does not break the law of gravity, it merely overpowers it for a time. Gravity is still in effect and will come into play again when the plane begins to decelerate. So the idea of making a decision or being given a moral pass, let's say, when you have to make a difficult decision, it's like this idea of gravity and you know, the plane coming into conflict. And so the laws of nature give this jetliner a pass, you know, to overcome these things. But it doesn't mean that the laws of nature stop happening, right? They continue happening, and the jetliner is subject to it again when it comes back down. But in this moment, it's temporarily exempted from following the laws of nature and gravity. Dietrich Bonhoeffer basically said that the church, not just individuals, should be the ones to step in and fight the injustice. So his issue is, he says, you know what? The problem is not that Christians aren't willing to do the right thing. The problem is that they're not willing to do the right thing en masse. So you've got, he believes that World War II would have never happened if the church had been united and had fought the injustice at the very beginning and hadn't left it up to individuals like himself and Corrie ten Boom and other people like that. So he says that the fact that we have to make these decisions is a failure of the church as a whole, because we shouldn't have to civilly disobey if we can influence the government correctly, which we could do if we just unified and actually did something, right? But unfortunately, again, the church isn't always able to do this, so we have to look at what we should do as individuals given the situation. There's a couple different ways of looking at this. One is Joseph Fletcher's situational ethics. People say, okay, if you're in a situation and that situation determines what decision you make, then isn't that the same as situational ethics? And the difference is, the situation doesn't determine the ethical decision, but the value of the two things you're deciding between makes the decision. So, yes, when you get placed in a situation where you have to make a decision, every situation is going to be different. That doesn't mean the situation determines your decision. It means that the two things you have to decide between, the value of those things, determine the choice. So it's not situational ethics. He basically says, depending on what the situation is, that's the choice you make. But we're not saying that. We're saying no matter what the situation, God comes first and people come second and things come last. So the reason that's different from the Christian worldview is because Fletcher says, in some situations, adultery is the loving response and stealing is the higher good. No action is intrinsically and absolutely right and wrong for all persons in all times and all circumstances. Now, he's saying, if you don't love your spouse, and it's just going to lead to trouble in the long run, you might as well just commit adultery so that you can have a healthy relationship with the person you're with. So you get your cake and eat it too, basically. And he's saying, because that way you don't have to divorce your spouse and lead to a messy situation, but you still get what you want and everything works out, right? Or he says, stealing is the higher good, because, right, if you really need something and you don't have access to it, then sometimes stealing becomes the right thing to do in the situation. And he's saying, that you can't say that one situation is always bad and always good. We kind of agree with that, right? But we would never assert that adultery is the right thing to do in a situation because we have a higher calling, right? We have to obey God, not ourselves first. And so that's why Fletcher's situational ethics are different from the greater good situation. An apologist friend of mine said, the situation is used to determine which absolutes are in conflict, but not which absolute is the greater or lesser. So that's why we have to look at Scripture to find out what the greater good is, and that way we can make decisions based in these situations. In the Old Testament, God gives us a lot of lessons and a lot of ways to tell us how we're supposed to act. And people say, oh, the Old Testament isn't valuable for us today in as far as moral prescription goes, but it is. It's still valuable. Romans 15:4 says, everything that was written in the past was written to teach us, so that through the endurance taught in the Scriptures and the encouragement they provide, we might have hope. 1 Corinthians 10 said, these things happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings for us. So everything that happened in the Old Testament, there is value to it. They are used to teach us. Now, does every single one have a moral prescription for us? Well, you have to look at it in light of the Old, the New Covenant, right? It depends on what it is. Some laws continued, the moral laws specifically continued, but what the ceremonial law and things like that, they faded away because we don't need them anymore. Where is the precedent in the Old Testament for God above man? Well, you have Abraham and Isaac, right? You have God telling Abraham, hey, go sacrifice your kid for me. And Abraham's like, I don't know about that. But guess what? He does it anyways. Because why? Because he obeyed God and he was blessed for his faith. Obviously, God didn't actually make him do it. He, you know, provided the ram just in time. But, you know, God does eventually sometimes call us to make these tough decisions. And we have, yeah, and we have to, and we're not allowed to test God, but he can definitely test us if he wants. Soren Kierkegaard calls this phenomenon a teleological suspension of the ethical. By his act, he overstepped the ethical entirely and possessed a higher teleos outside of it, in relation to which he suspended the former. So what he's saying is Abraham was suspended from the sin of killing his son. If he killed his son in that moment, it wouldn't have been considered a sin, right? Because God is commanding him to do so. So he was relieved, he was temporarily relieved of the ethical decision not to kill. And so because of that, he was able to obey God. But obviously we know that God, again, intervened and stepped in. However, again, unlike that third alternative that Aquinas keeps praying for, we can't assume that God's going to swoop in at the last minute and save us, right? We have to still make a decision based on what the information that we have. Another example is the Hebrew midwives, right? Exodus 1, the Pharaoh tells the Hebrew midwives, hey, go kill the Hebrew babies when they're born. There's too many of them. But the Hebrew midwives, however, feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt had told them. They let the boys live. Now what happens is Pharaoh's like, what the heck's going on? These women are giving birth and you're not killing the babies. Obviously the Hebrew midwives are like, well, first of all, they're Hebrews. We don't want to kill them. And second of all, they knew it was wrong because they followed the God of, or Jehovah, the God of the Old Testament. So they go and they tell Pharaoh, the Hebrew women, they're too quick. They have the babies too quick and then they hide them. Their labor's not very long and we can't get to them before they give birth and then they hide the babies. Well, obviously that's not what's happening. They were just not killing the babies. So they tell this lie to Pharaoh, right? There's little question that the midwives both disobeyed a command of government by not murdering the newborn male children and lied to cover it up. The moral dilemma in which the midwives found themselves was unavoidable. So what happens? They chose life over obedience to what? Unholy government, right? So instead of bowing to an unholy government and then causing them to deny God, they chose what? The sanctity of life, which we're going to talk about in the second half. But God blessed the women in spite of the fact they had disobeyed authority and lied about it. Why? Because they chose the greater good, right? So people are always like, oh, well, see, look, that's an example. See, God's rewarding people for sinning. God's rewarding people for doing the wrong decision. But the problem is that you've got Rahab, right? Mm-hmm. Joshua 2. Rahab saves spies, and she lies. And then what happens? Jericho comes tumbling down, and Rahab's house is the only one that's preserved. And the crazy thing is, actually, in archaeology, if you go look at the site of Jericho, they've actually found evidence of a piece of the wall that was the only piece of the wall that didn't fall, and there was a dwelling in it. And so it's crazy because you can almost prove her story with archaeological evidence. But, you know, people were like, oh, look, Rahab was rewarded for lying. But the thing is that she's not rewarded for lying. What she's rewarded for, choosing to serve the Hebrew God as opposed to serving the Canaanite gods or government, right? So one thing I want to write is that, or say, is that another way of looking at the situation is that lying only involves a breaking of trust when we have a duty to tell the truth. Because in this situation, Pharaoh had wicked intentions, the Hebrew midwives were released from having to tell Pharaoh the truth. Same thing with Rahab. She's dealing with an unholy government. So then Bonhoeffer brings up a good point. Well, what about in times of war? There's lots of war in the Old Testament, right? Well, what about when Joshua is going into war and he lays traps for his enemy? There's deception involved, right? So you've got Bonhoeffer doing the same thing. You've got the city of Ai with Joshua laying traps for the people and the Moabites and the Ammonites. And so you've got all these examples of Joshua. He's not playing fair. He's doing things that are really conniving and cunning and almost seem like, gosh, like that's really deceptive. I don't know about that. But he was doing it for a good reason, right? He was doing it to reclaim the land for God. And so because of this, he wasn't punished for lying to the enemy in war. And then Dietrich Bonhoeffer again talks about how, look, he says, if saluting Hitler or camouflaging the real purpose of my activities means that I can save people and serve God, then I'm okay with that. And in reality, I mean, that's really what you have to think about. Like, you know, should we deny God in public to save people? Well, that's iffy. Bible would say no. But on the flip side, can you praise an evil leader while secretly going about God's business? That's really kind of an interesting dichotomy there. God allows you to, let's say, bow down to the gods of this world in order to bring about his means, but he doesn't let you deny him in order to bring about the world. I don't know. So it's kind of interesting, an interesting dichotomy there. Because honestly, I do believe Dietrich Bonhoeffer is in heaven. I don't think he was denied entrance because he saluted to Hitler, because he was planning to assassinate him in secret. And so he basically says, sometimes one is forced to do questionable things for the goal of the greater good, to restore truth-telling in the public square, and overall to bring justice back to society. Second question is, what about in times of unholy rule? I talked about before. King Saul, right? King Saul is like going nuts, right? And everyone's like, okay, what do we do with this guy? Samuel's like, I gotta find a new king because this guy's, he's gotta be out. And he's not a good king anymore. He's not serving God. So what do we do? Well, God tells Samuel, hey, go anoint this little shepherd boy named David, right? But what does God tell? Samuel's like, Saul will kill me if I do that, right? And so what does God tell Samuel? Tell him you're gonna go offer a sacrifice. Tell him that's what you're doing, but then go anoint David. So God here is telling Samuel to lie to Saul to be able to anoint David, right? But to get out of it, Samuel actually goes and does the sacrifice, but on the way back, he anoints David as next king, right? So God's clever, right? So he gives Samuel this way of being able to do God's will, but also to be able to lie to Saul and get away with it. And you see God specifically straight out instructing Samuel to lie or have a deception. And so we do see that God does allow stuff like that when it becomes necessary. And then David eating the showbread, right? David and his army are starving. Technically, according to law, they were not supposed to eat the showbread of the temple. But what happens? He eats the showbread and he's like, the priest is like, like, yeah, whatever, I don't care. And it's because, right, because the whole thing is that you're preserving people over things, right? Showbird is a thing. It's not a person that needs nourishment to survive. And so in order to survive and to serve God, David was able to do with greater good. Another example, King Nebuchadnezzar, right? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Daniel and the lions. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego obviously decide to serve God over man, and they get thrown in the fiery furnace, and God delivers them. The angel of the Lord shows up, and God delivers them. Then what happens with Daniel? They tell Daniel, you can't pray to your God anymore. Daniel prays. The guys that don't like him get him in trouble. They throw him in the lion's den, and he miraculously shuts the lion's mouths, right? So there are examples of people in the Old Testament being rewarded, or saved for obeying God. Can we guarantee that? No, because it might be God's will that you die. However, these guys just happen to have God in war for them. But again, we can't wait for that third alternative. We just have to choose to obey God and accept the consequences. King Obadiah and King Ahab. This is kind of a very great example of what was going to come later. Here we have Ahab saying, you got to kill all the prophets. All the prophets got to go, Ahab and Jezebel. They're like, we got to kill all the prophets. And Obadiah actually hid the prophets. He took 100 prophets and hid them in 2 caves, put 50 in each, and supplied them with food and water. So this is kind of like a first instance of, like, you know, kind of like what happened in World War II and the Underground Railroad. And this is really setting a precedent there for when people are being told to kill innocent people, that it's our job to actually hide them and save them from the people who are trying to kill them. What about the sacrificial system? So this is an example of the greater good, because people are always like, oh, why did God have to kill animals, you know, for human sin? Sin's an intangible thing. And so people are like, why would you have to kill a physical animal in order to get rid of sin that's not even a physical thing? What's the point in that? If there could have been a spiritual sacrifice, let's say, that's not physical. But here, there's obviously symbolism in the sacrificial system. When a priest would kill an animal, he'd actually put his hand on the head of the animal and transfer the sins of the people into that animal. And then he would basically transfer their spiritual qualities by transferring their sin to the animal, condemning it to die in their place. As mentioned above, obviously, there are many places in the Bible where God speaks against killing animals, right? So God tells you, don't just kill animals for no reason, right? Only for what? Food and clothing. But he tells people, take care of your creation. But this seems like we're just killing animals to kill them, right? Because it's not feeding anyone. No one eats the sacrifice. Well, the priest eats a little bit of it, but the priest, most of it goes to waste, in a sense. And so people are like, how can God justify something like this? But what is the greater good? The greater good is that it's a temporary holding place for people to be able to, let's say, go to Abraham's bosom and wait for the Messiah to come to be the final sacrifice. So it was killed instead for the greater good and the eternal lives of all those involved. So this is an example of the greater good here. New Testament. What's the example in the New Testament of choosing the greater good? Obviously, Jesus is ministering the Gospels, right? Nobody wanted him to do what he was doing. The Pharisees didn't want him. The Sadducees didn't want him. A lot of the people didn't want him. But guess what? He did it anyways, because he knew he had a higher calling above and beyond what the human beings wanted. You know, turned over the tables in the temple, did lots of things that were against what the law of the land was, right? He did a lot of things that he technically didn't break the law, right? But he did things that Caesar and the high priest disagreed with. Or, for example, like when he breaks the Sabbath law, right? And he says, well, is the Sabbath, is a man made for Sabbath, or is Sabbath made for man? And he's like, you're holding this law too high. The law is not supposed to be your highest, God is supposed to be your highest authority, not the law. And so he's trying to make that distinction there. What's better? Better that I heal this man's hand, or better that I obey your law? What's the better choice there? And then evangelism and Acts. Obviously, Peter and Paul were constantly told to stop.
and they didn't. So that's an example of choosing the greater good over what other people are saying. And then lastly, the crucifixion is the greatest precedent. Obviously, condemning someone to die on a punishment like the cross, that's pretty bad, right? And so a lot of people look at it and they're like, how could God do that to his son? If sin is an intangible thing, how come God couldn't just wipe away everyone's sin? Why did there have to be Jesus sent to die? Steve Chalk, who was an emergent author, he says, Jesus' work on the cross was a form of cosmic child abuse, a vengeful father punishing his son for an offense he has not even committed. So here we have God killing an innocent man on the cross, right? But what's the greater good? The greater good is that even though in this instance someone had to die, the greater good is that what we are saved from our sins and he rises. And he doesn't even really stay dead. I mean, it was a bad death, but he ends up coming back. And so the greatest precedent for choosing the greater good in a situation where it's conflicting absolutes, should I let this innocent person die or should I obey God? What's the choice there? The choice is obey God because the crucifixion. An innocent man did die, but there was a greater purpose to that. And so I think this is the best example of choosing the greater good in a situation. Lastly, conclusion is that biblical absolutism is monistic, meaning that it's the one basic principle as a foundation of reality, in the sense that one should always do what God commands them to do. However, built into that principle is the idea that such commands include doing what is the weightiest good. In effect, God commands us to always do the greatest good, and that never gets violated. In conclusion, that specific command to do the greater good is not just a greater absolute, but is in actuality a simply unqualified absolute. So what he's saying is that when it comes down to obeying God does not simply become the greatest good, it becomes the only choice in the situation. And so he's saying it's unqualified absolute, meaning across the board, no matter what situation you're in, obeying God is always what you're supposed to do. Now, there's obviously underneath that nuances of how you obey God, and that's what the scripture is for. And definitely different situations determine different ways you're going to have to do that. But regardless of what action you take in that situation, it needs to be the one that obeys God. And that's how you make the decision based in an ethical dilemma. So, because of that, when we talk about abortion, which is the topic I'm going to do in the next hour, that is an example of this. Because here we have people that are killing babies simply for convenience, right? So they're saying, well, I just, don't feel like having a kid right now. But that's not obeying God, right? Obeying God would be saving the baby and then making a choice after that based on whether you give it up for adoption or you keep it or whatever. So fighting abortion is what we're called to do as Christians. You have Roe v. Wade, which is a law, but guess what? Civil disobedience calls us to what? Fight that law and try to get it changed. So how do we do that? We do that through teaching people why there's a good case against abortion. So that's what we're going to go through in the next hour. So before I go on, does anybody have any questions?
Can I see conclusion rule?
Oh, wait, sorry, which one?
Conclusion.
Oh, the conclusion, yeah, sure.
Yes.
And I know that was like a lot, but that's basically an entire philosophy class. one hour. So
what's the Christian response about telling lies to our children about Santa Claus?
They would say you don't tell them lies about Santa Claus, but you tell them what they need to know at the age of their at. So, for example, like my son, I was never allowed to know that Santa was real. Growing up, my parents put "from Jesus" on all the presents, and but with my son, because he doesn't fully understand the difference between tangibles and intangibles, I let him believe certain things and straighten out certain things. So you're not lying. You are giving someone the information they need at the moment they need it. And so, like, with my son, I tell him, yes, Santa was a real person. You know, does he come down your chimney at night and bring you presents? No. But the spirit of Santa and St. Nicholas and what he represents is still, you know. So I think that there are ways of doing it without shattering kids, you know, life. But I think you just have to be sensitive to the idea that, that revelation is progressive for us as human beings, because when we're young, we can't fully understand everything. But then as we get older, it's important that we don't continue that lie. If you let your kid believe it into adulthood, that would be a problem. That would be a problem. Because you're perpetuating a lie when they're at a point where they can accept the truth.
What I worry about is the child, when he first realizes there is no Santa Claus, and you've told him there is,
yeah,
is he going to say, well, there is no Jesus either?
Right.
You lied to me before, and
right,
is this imaginary thing too now?
Right. But then at that point, you get to have that great conversation where you explain the difference between why you let them believe in Santa, as opposed, you know, and the difference between him and Jesus. And, I don't think very few logical kids would hold on to that anger and deny Jesus simply because Santa's not real. I mean, that's not something that, that typically people carry into adulthood. But I mean, that's when you tell kids, well, you know what, let's research, let's find out. Like, I think it actually opens a great door to be able to explain the difference between Santa and Jesus.
Yeah, that's,
you know, and so I think that it's an opportunity as opposed to, but yeah, I think you just have to deal with people where their faculties are at. You know, my son, for a very long time, I had friends who were like, well, my kid accepted Jesus at 3. Why isn't your kid saved yet? And I'm like, well, because he doesn't understand why God is real, but he can't see him. Because he doesn't understand metaphors and intangibles until he got to be a little bit older. And then he was like, okay, now I get it. Now I understand. And so, you know, I just had to trust that in that window, there was the age of accountability, and that, you know, because I was teaching about Jesus, it was enough. But yeah, I think we just kind of have to deal with people where their faculties are at. But I personally, from very early, told my son the difference. I said, yes, St. Nicholas was a real person. However, you know, so I think there's a happy medium for sure. But I'm not going to ever tell a parent, oh, you shouldn't let your kid believe in Santa Claus. Because maybe they're able to do it in such a way that their kid won't hate them. I don't know. Okay. So, so now we're going to go into the case for the anti-abortion position. I used to speak on this a lot because I worked for a pro-life organization that their whole job was to save babies from abortion and convince women who were on their way to get an abortion to not. So in a year and a half, I got basically a master's degree in pro-life apologetics just by doing that job. But then people are always like, well, why do you say anti-abortion and not pro-life? People are always like, why don't you argue for the positive? Why don't you argue for the pro side? And I'm like, well, the problem is pro-life is too broad. When you talk about pro-life issues, you're talking about, like, death penalty, euthanasia. I mean, you're talking about so many different things that you have to be very specific. And so because people, what they'll do is they'll assume, oh, you're pro-life? Oh, that means you're against the death penalty. No. I'm actually pro-death penalty because the Bible is okay with it. but you'd have to be dealing with a lot of different issues if you just said I'm to be pro-life. Also, the difference is innocent versus guilt. The reason I'm not pro, or the reason that I'm pro death penalty is because that person's guilty, whereas you've got babies that are being killed, but they're innocent. And so there's a difference there. So people will say, well, I'm pro-life, but pro-life means you're anti-death penalty because you're pro-life, everything life. There's a difference there. The difference is innocence and guilt. And so I typically take the position of anti-abortion as opposed to pro-life. All right. So, Jean Garden, who is just recently passed away, she was a very strong pro-life advocate after Roe v. Wade. And she said, I spent many months of study and research examining the issue from various disciplines and perspectives. I read the law, medicine, and history. I studied scripture and the church fathers. I worked long and hard to discover evidence to support my theory. So at this point, she's pro-choice. So she used to be pro-choice. She says, but I found none. I either had to face up to reality and change my position or continue to try and change reality by disguising the truth. It was then, borrowing from the words of C.S. Lewis, what he spoke after he converted to the Christian faith that he had set out to discredit, I was carried kicking and screaming into the pro-life position by the sheer weight of the evidence. So the story is that C.S. Lewis was a reluctant Christian. He was an atheist and he didn't want Christianity to be true because what that imposes moral responsibility on you, right? And so he's like, I don't want Christianity to be true. But Jean Garten was pro-choice and she's like, I don't want the pro-life position to be true, because if it is, that means I got a lot of I have to change my position. And so, but she after doing all the research, she was carried kicking and screaming into the pro-life position by the sheer weight of the evidence. That's kind of what we're going to do today, is talk about what is the sheer weight of the evidence, what is the evidence against abortion. So we're going to go through six things, which I'll go through each one of these. So we're going to go through it philosophically, logically, scientific, medically, psychologically, historically, and then last, biblically. And the reason I do biblically last is because I want people to see this as a logical position outside of my religious convictions, which a lot of people will say, oh, look, you're a Christian. That's the only reason that you're anti-abortion. But really, there's so many more reasons besides that. The first reason I'm against abortion is because of philosophy. Specifically in philosophy, something called the law of identity. The law of identity says A is A, right? Basically, whatever is true of one is true of the other because they're the exact same thing. So here's the argument that you get first. It's my body, therefore what? My choice, right? If it's my body, I have the right to choose. It's the number one argument against people who are pro-choice. Unfortunately, it's got flawed logic. According to the law of identity, A is only A if they share the exact same attributes, right? Every single thing about them has to be exactly the same or they're not identical. But guess what? The mother and the baby are not exactly the same. The mom doesn't have the exact same DNA as their kid. They have half the same DNA, right? Because they share 23 chromosomes. But the baby has the DNA of the father as well. So the baby and the mom are not identical. It's so funny because my son, he was like, oh, mom, do you want, we had bought a drink. And I was like, okay, I have to drink it first and then you can have the rest. And he was like, well, why? He's like, why can't I drink it and then you have the rest? And I was like, because. It's like, you have all my DNA, but I don't have all your DNA. And I don't want to be sharing any of your DNA, you know. And it was a joke because, you know, I was just joking. Because really, it's more that I have I'm a germaphobe and I have an issue about drinking after other people. But, you know, I was like, you have my spit, but I don't have your spit. So I go first and then it won't affect you the way it affects me. And I mean, when you think about that, that's really the case with abortion. You're talking about someone who has different DNA than you. And the baby shares half the DNA of the father. Therefore, you're different people, right? You're different things. You're not identical. So you can't say it's my body because guess what? It's not. It's not your body. And that's a philosophical argument. It's against the law of identity. Also, Think about this. What about male babies and female mothers? Right? Not the same gender. Different DNA there. What about babies with Down syndrome who have an extra chromosome? Right? People, and Down syndrome is like the number one reason people abort, is because they find out they have a baby with Down syndrome. But they're like, oh, well, it's my body, it's my choice. Well, actually, if your baby has Down syndrome and you don't, that's an argument for not aborting them, because they have an extra chromosome that you don't have, therefore you're not the same. So the unborn child is not just a part of the mother's body, so she does not have the right to choose based on that reasoning. Second, legally, no one, man, woman, or child, has an absolute right of control over his or her own body. So you think, oh, it's my body, I have absolute control. You know, no one can decide what to do with my body outside of me. But the laws of society, for example, do not permit us to mutilate our bodies or abuse them with drugs. A body which has consumed alcohol is not permitted to just get behind the wheel of a car. A body which has participated in the craze of streaking and runs nude down Main Street found the argument of the right to control one's own body ineffective as a defense. Because all life is interrelated, many individual rights are partial and not absolute. So you can say, it's my body, but guess what? You don't have absolute control over your own body in society, because what you do to your body affects other people. And so you have these situations where if you drink too much alcohol and you get behind the wheel of a car, well, it's my body, yes, but now you've become a weapon. And now you could potentially hurt other people. And this is where abortion is. You're hurting other people, regardless if it's your body or not. And so you can't just say, oh, it's my body, and therefore I have absolute autonomy, I can do whatever I want, because we're a society and we're all interrelated. Secondly, because of the law of identity, soul means personhood, right? So the second argument that you get from pro-choicers is, first, what, it's my body. Second, it's not a person, right? Well, the law of identity basically means that you are two separate beings, right? And if you're two separate beings, then there's consequences to that. And those who appeal to abortion most often do not hold to the mind-body dualism, which we talked about before, the mind and the soul and the body and the brain, or the mind and the brain and the body and the soul are two separate things. So to them, if you're someone who doesn't believe that, you're a monist, you believe that mankind is just physical or material, therefore no soul. So, but the problem is that if you have, and I'm going to write this, I'm about to talk about J.B. Moreland, and if you've ever read J.B. Moreland, then you know you have to write things down, because he's very, very, very smart. Okay, so a dualist is someone who believes that the mind and the brain are two separate things. Now, when I say brain, what do I mean? I mean actual physical brain matter. So let's say you get an accident and your head hits the curb. What's spilling out of your head is what we call brain matter, right? So physical brain matter. But can you define what a mind is? The mind's immaterial, right? So this is not physical, right? So if you're a dualist, you believe that what you think in your brain is different than your actual brain. So this is the vehicle that houses this force, right? So that they're separate. A monist is someone who believes that they're the same. One. So in this situation, the things that are happening in your brain, your mind, are only chemical synapses firing in your brain. So anything you think, your thoughts, your logic, is a result of your brain just having chemical physical reactions. So they're the same. So this is a byproduct of this, where in this situation they're completely separate things. This just houses this. So in this situation, you would say, okay, the law of identity says that these are the same thing. So what happens is, law of identity is that A equals A, right? So they would say the mind and the brain are the same. But the law of identity says, no, they're only the same if they're exactly the same. But guess what? There are things that are true about this that aren't true about this. And there are things that are true about this that aren't true about this. Therefore, they cannot be the same, right? So the law of identity not only gives the case that the baby and the mother are different, but it also gives the case that the mind and the brain are different. And because of that, guess what? That imposes personhood on the baby. So, for example, thoughts cannot be physical state of the brain. Why? Because there are things that are true of my thoughts that are not true of a physical state of my brain. It does not make any sense to ask how many inches long my thoughts are. How much do they weigh? Is that thought closer to my left ear or closer to my right ear? What geometrical shape does that thought have? Is it sort of a weird shape, or is it a square or a rectangle? That's all nonsense. However, while I am thinking, the state that is going on in my brain at that time does have a shape. It is located in, say, my left or right hemisphere, so it will be closer to my left or right ear. It will have a certain mass and chemical composition. And there is something true of a thought that cannot be true of a brain state. Thoughts can be true or false. Brain states can neither be true or false. They just exist. So there are things that are true of my thoughts that cannot be true of my brain state, and thoughts that cannot be the same thing as my brain state. Basically, what he's saying is you have thoughts, but can you say how long a thought is or give it some physicality? What shape is a thought? If you can't say specifically what a thought looks like or an idea, well, that's all part of the mind, right? That all comes from the mind. But they're of a different substance than the physical matter of your brain, right? So if you know there's a difference between these two, because they're not the same, right? You can't put a quantity, a quantifier on this, or a shape or something, but you can with this. And so what he's saying is that because the mind and the brain have different aspects to them, one's not physical and one is physical, you can open up someone's head and look at their brain. You can't open someone's head and look at their mind, right? But we know a mind is a thing. So because of that, the law of identity says, look, the mind and the brain are not the same thing, right? Because they have to have the exact same attributes. They have to both be physical or both be not physical, but they're two different things. Because of that, because of the law of identity, we can say philosophically, the case is that if the mind and the brain are not the same and we have both, then that presupposes a personhood or a mind in every human being, which means that the baby is a person, right? So, if you murder a child and they have a soul, that's what? It's wrong, right? So I call it committing identity theft against the unborn, because what you're doing is you're taking away their identity, right? You're killing them and you're stealing the fact that they have a personhood. Jean Garten shares this story. She says, one day, Abraham Lincoln asked a group of men a question. He said, how many legs would a sheep have if you called a tail a leg? Five, they answered. He said, you are mistaken, for the sheep would still have four legs, because calling something a leg does not make it so. And so the idea there is that logically, right, just because we call a baby something different doesn't actually mean that it's a different thing, right? We're just calling it something different. So that's what goes into the next one, logic. This is logically why we should be against abortion, or what I call the duh factors, right? Things that are just obvious that we shouldn't even have to argue, but we do. The first argument is called the SLED argument. This is by a man named Scott Klusendorf, who is probably the best pro-life apologist in the world. He has a great book called The Case for Life, which I recommend getting. He says, there is no morally significant difference between the embryo that you once were and the adult that you are today. Think of the acronym SLED as a helpful reminder of these non-essential differences. For example, size. Newborns are a different size, than adults. Embryos are smaller than newborns, right? But why does it seem like it's so much more wrong to kill a newborn than it is to kill an embryo? Because people look at size as a factor, right? They determine, well, it's a lot smaller, so maybe it's not a person yet. But unfortunately, size doesn't determine value, because if it did, Shaq would be more valuable than Albert Einstein, right? And we know that mind and body are different in that category, obviously. You know, Albert Einstein is valued for his mind, whereas Shaq is valued for his physical ability. And so size doesn't determine value, because then you'd have to determine that some humans are more valuable than others based on size. Level of development. So true embryos and fetuses are less developed than the adults they'll one day become. But why is this relevant? 4-year-old girls are less developed than 14-year-old ones. Should older children have more rights than their younger siblings? And I don't mean responsibility, I mean rights. Like, one should be able to live and one shouldn't. Some people say that self-awareness makes one human. But if that's true, then newborns don't qualify as human beings because they lack the capacity to be self-aware. Six weeks old infants lack the immediate capacity for performing human mental functions, as do the comatose, the sleeping, and those with Alzheimer's disease. So there's lots of different factors that determine a level of development, but it shouldn't determine someone's value. Environment, where you are, has no bearing on your value. So what do I mean by that? What I mean is that if the birth canal is, let's say, 7 to 8 inches long, I'm not a person here and then not a person here, or vice versa. I'm not a person here and then all of a sudden I become a person because I moved 7 inches to the right or whatever it is. So your environment doesn't change your value. Again, think of World War II Germany, right? Just because you were a Jew in Germany, you were considered not a person, but a Jew everywhere else was considered a person, right? So your environment determined your value in that society. Dred Scott case. In 1857, it was decided that if you were born in Africa, you were less human than someone born in America. But just because someone decides that your environment is a factor, that doesn't mean it actually is. Environment does not determine value. And so, and something may be legal, but again, like we talked about before, it doesn't make it right. Lastly, D, degree of dependency. If viability makes us human, then those who depend on medication to live are not valuable and we can kill them. So basically they say, oh, well, babies, because they're like, because they're dependent on another human being and they can't live on their own, that they're not, they don't have value as a human being. But guess what? There's lots of people who are dependent on other people to live. And that doesn't mean we should just go around killing them all. So the logic is just not there. Second, 95% of the reasons women get abortions are related to convenience and are not medical. So the one thing you'll get from pro-choicers is that, guess what, abortion only happens because the life of the mother is in danger or it's a medical reason. They will not admit that convenience is the reason behind it. Under the convenience bar or box, you can see, oh, it's just postponement of childbearing. To end childbearing, being a parent costs too much money, it'll disrupt my work or education, my partner doesn't want a baby, or my parents don't agree, or they feel like I'm too immature. So this is about 25%, this is about 20-25%, 15%, 12%, 11%, and then 5-10%. So that leaves about 5% for this box here. Endangerment of mother health, abnormalities in the fetus, and other. And guess what? When it comes to the United States, it's not even a factor at all. Because we don't have we're not in Bangladesh where the mother could die if she has a baby. We are in the United States where that is not a factor anymore. So to say that, we can justify abortion because, it's life of the mother, the facts are just not there for that. Other reasons people use to justify abortion, they say, oh, it's just a higher form of animal, and which we'll get to that in a second. It's not true. They say it's not viable before birth, therefore not worthy of life. Well, right after it's born, it's not able to take care of itself either, so should we just throw it away then? It's unwanted. Okay, so there are lots of orphans in the world, so we just go through all the orphanages and get rid of them too. say a child may be a financial burden. Well, they're going to be one their whole life. So you can always do adoption, right? There are plenty of people who can't have kids that would pay lots of money to raise yours. The child, it's a product of rape or incest. Well, but that's not the baby's fault, right? So what do? You punish the person who's, you know, the wrongdoer, and you adopt out the baby. Or they say, guess what, abortion's legal, I can do what I want. Yes, but that doesn't make it right. As we stated before, there are plenty of laws in the world that say things like this person's not a person, or the Jews are not people, or in Civil War, African Americans were people, but that doesn't make it right. So just because something's legal doesn't make it right. So those are the duh factors. Next, we're going to go into science and medicine. So what does science and medicine say? And this one I like because everybody will accept this as fact. People are like, you know, if you can give scientific evidence for something, they're like more likely to listen to you than otherwise. So in an embryology textbook, it says, scientifically, we know that from the earliest stages of development, the unborn are distinct, living, and whole human beings. Leading embryology books confirm this. That's from a textbook in 1993. So that's interesting. Stages of development, there's lots of evidence that the baby is a full functioning human being from the very beginning. For example, a baby's heart begins to beat 18 days from conception, right? So 18 days after it's conceived, their heart starts to beat. Can you hear it? No. So if you hook someone up to a fetal monitor, you couldn't hear it because it's too low. But the science is that it does start beating 18 days. By 21 days, the heart is pumping blood through a closed circulatory system. Brain waves are detected at 6 weeks. 8 weeks from conception, you can hear the heartbeat. But here's my question. If the baby's heartbeat begins at 18 days from conception, and this is science, and we determine that someone's life is ended when their heart stops, how come we don't determine that life begins when their heart starts? So, I mean, that's, you know, if we say, oh, the determining factor of someone's dead is because their heart's not beating anymore, the monitor has flatlined, and we say time of death, right? Well, how come we don't determine that it's beginning when the heart starts? Science textbooks, I love this because I have lots of them and they contradict themselves constantly. Science textbooks, what do they say? What are people learning in school? By 7 months, which is about 28 weeks gestation, the fetus looks from the outside like a tiny normal baby, but it is not. It's page 557. And then another book says, the ability of organisms to reproduce their own kind is the one characteristic that best distinguishes living things from non-living matter. Only amoebas produce more amoebas, only people make more people, and only maple trees produce more maple trees. These simple facts of life have been recognized for thousands of years and are summarized by the age-old saying, like begets like. Now, these are secular textbooks. These are not Christian textbooks. But it's funny that one is like, yeah, at 7 months, the fetus looks like a baby, but it's not. But then this other one's saying, but human beings can only beget human beings. So if you're saying that it's not a baby, what is it here? Is it a dog? Is it a cat? Like what? A fish? What are we talking about? If it's not a baby. Human beings only beget human beings. So it can't be anything but a human being. That's just science. you've got two different science textbooks from two different years telling you different things. So no wonder young people are completely confused, right? Because they're getting mixed messages all over the place. Another problem is Haeckel's embryos. Now, almost everybody has seen this image in their science textbooks. It's still in textbooks today. The similarity between early stages in the development of many different animals helped convince Darwin that all forms of life shared common ancestors. So Ernst Haeckel was a doctor, and he drew these, and he said, this is what the embryonic stages look like. Look, at the very beginning, all the embryos of all these animals, including humans, look all the same, right? And so his point is, they're no different at that stage, right? And so he's saying, look, humans are just animals. Okay, well, so no wonder people are okay with killing their babies if they eat eggs and they eat meat, and what's the difference, right? So basically, in its earliest form, the embryo could potentially become anything, is kind of what his point was, right? We're the same as other species. In 1860, Ernst Haeckel read Darwin's book, and he faked the embryo drawings to help the theory of evolution out because he was a doctor and people trusted him. In 1874, Haeckel was convicted of fraud. Okay? He was tried in a court case, and this was determined to not be accurate. It's still in textbooks today. When asked why, the head of the National Center for Science and Education, Eugenie Scott, she was asked straight up, why are you still using this image if it's not true? And she's like, it's cheap to reproduce. I'm like, you know what's cheaper? Leaving it out completely. But they don't want to have to change things constantly. So they just leave it in. So when you see this, the message is humans and animals are the same at the embryonic stage, right? Therefore, it doesn't matter if you kill one because it's not human, technically, at that point. But the difference is what they really look like. So this is Ernst Haeckel's versions, and this is what they really look like in real life under a microscope. So they're different, right? It's very clear that you can see that they're different. So truth matters. My next question is, if it's 7 months gestation, a fetus is not a baby, then what about preemies? Right? We have babies that are born at 24 weeks and they survive. And the fetus, they said, wasn't a baby, it was at 28 weeks. This is Lily. Lily was born at 23 weeks gestation, which is about 6 months, and she survived. There's many more stories like this. Time magazine actually did a study, and they found out 34% of babies born at 5.5 months, which is 22 weeks, survive. So if a fetus is not a baby at 28 weeks, it's just not reality. It just, science does not back it up, and neither does medicine. An even larger percentage survive at 7 months, so we shouldn't be saying that these things are not babies, because they are. So the question is, what do the facts show? Do the facts show that it's just a clump of cells, or do the facts show that it's an actual child? Jean Garten says, we cannot dehumanize others without becoming less human ourselves. The second we start looking at other people as if they're not human or less than human, that's when you start having cultural crises. That leads to the evils of the world. So science and medicine are on our side. What about psychology? Studies have shown that not only does abortion have negative long-term effects on post-abortive women, but that the culture that accepts abortion has negatively affected society as a whole as well. So this whole psychology of a society that accepts abortion is out of whack, basically. PTSD. 65% of women who choose abortion suffer from symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Women who abort experience an 81% increase in risk for mental health problems. It significantly increases risk for clinical depression, anxiety, drug and alcohol abuse, PTSD, and suicidal thoughts or behavior. And I'm not making these things up. This is from the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology. The scientific evidence indicates that abortion is more likely to be associated with negative psychological outcomes when compared to miscarriage or carrying an unintended pregnancy to term. So if you don't want your child and you still carry it and you give birth and you give it away, you experience less psychological damage than if you have an abortion. And so that's one of the excuses that you get a lot is they'll say, well, I don't think I could handle carrying my child to term and then giving it up. Yes, it's damaging. But I have a parent that's done both, and she says that the abortion was much worse than giving her daughter up for adoption. And so maybe at the end I'll share a little bit of my story, but one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this is because when my mom was 15, she had an abortion, and then when she wasn't a Christian. Then when she was 23, I think like 20, something like that, she had a little girl, or she got pregnant again. She got pregnant, but she wasn't married. And she knew that she couldn't have another abortion because it ruined her. And so she decided to give my sister up for adoption. She found a nice Christian family in Orange County and gave her up for adoption. And, you know, she says that it's the psychological PTSD of the abortion is much worse than giving her daughter up for adoption. And she's now 60, she's going to be 63 this year, and she still struggles with it. And so the side effects, they never go away. They're not something that you can just be like, oh, I'm just going to have this abortion and not think about it for the rest of my life. that doesn't work. It doesn't happen. You can be forgiven, and God can help you through it, but you'll never forget. And I think that's one of the problems, is you deal with the guilt for the rest of your life. How does it affect men? This isn't just a female problem. Men throughout history, men in power, have had a tendency to persecute women, limit their freedoms and powers, and use them for their own devices. This is accomplished through either political or social actions, like Roe v. Wade, where all the Supreme Court justices were men, or China's one-child policy, or through passive inaction, sitting by and letting women bear society's burdens. In America today, the number of women suffering abuse at the hands of men is staggering. Abortion is a manifestation of man's proclivity to exploit women taken to the extreme. Abortion allows men to carry out their grand social plans as well as exercise their private passions without commitment or responsibility. You wonder why dudes are like, well, it's her body, she can do whatever she wants. They don't want to have to deal with the decision, right? They want to be able to just have sex and do whatever the heck they want, and they want to never, ever have to have responsibility. So, of course, they're going to support pro-choice legislation, right? Because it means that they can just do whatever the heck they want, and they'll have no responsibility. And so we think that this sexual revolution and this feminist movement is pro-woman, but it's actually pro-men, because it means that we're relieving them of any type of responsibility they would have to have. Because we're putting the entire burden on the woman to make the decision. And that's really not fair, since what, two people made the baby, therefore two people should be involved in the decision making. Feminist Dorchen Lightholt states, sexually liberal men support abortion for women not because they want women to be able to have control over their own bodies, but because they know unrestricted abortions heighten women's availability to men for sex. If she's not sidelined by a pregnancy for 10 months, then it doesn't mean any inconvenience for you. Jean Garten says, before the Supreme Court decision of 1973, sexual activity was taken seriously. Both the individuals involved, their families, and the community, which provided shelters and orphanages, felt a responsibility for the child that might result. Basically, they felt a responsibility to teach young people that if they weren't ready for a kid, they shouldn't have sex. Today, with abortion available and employed as an after-the-fact contraceptive, such responsibility is optional. The community no longer has a stake in whether or not you get pregnant. They don't care because they don't have to deal with it, but because you could just get rid of it. But in the past, that wasn't an option. So the entire community was actively teaching young people not to have sex because they didn't want to have to deal with the unwanted children that would result. Now they don't have to worry about that. Men, unfortunately, look at abortion as a get-out-of-jail-free card. Sometimes they'll pay for it, sometimes they won't. When I worked at Online for Life, we got calls all the time from women who are like, well, I wouldn't have an abortion if my partner supported me. Or, I'm with a married guy, and he's giving me the money so that he doesn't have to deal with the consequences of our affair. Lots of women who feel trapped, and for men, it's just a get-out-of-jail-free card. My former boss wrote a book called Abortion, the Ultimate Exploitation of Women, and it's a great book. It says, abortion is the ultimate get-out-of-jail-free card for sexually aggressive men. Men can continue having sexual relations with multiple women, refuse to commit to any one of them in marriage, and divorce a woman through a no-fault divorce. And if along the way a woman gets pregnant, the man has avoided all obligation to that woman for his child. Maybe they cough up a few $100 for the abortion. Maybe not. studies show that women experiencing a lack of support and pressure to abort from their partners were more likely to choose abortion. 76% of women said they would not have had an abortion if they had been strongly encouraged to keep their child by their partner. 76% would not have gotten an abortion if their partner supported them in keeping the child. So that's huge. Unfortunately, men are not only the perpetrators, but they're also the victims. So, what about the father who never had a say? What about fathers whose wives wanted to get an abortion and they didn't have a choice? This is their child, too. And so, unfortunately, by giving the woman the entire choice, we basically eliminated the ability for men to fight for their children. What if a guy wants to keep his child? There's a story of the guy who runs 40 Days for Life, and he was outside an abortion clinic, praying for the women inside, and a father came running up to him and said, "My wife is inside. Can you please stop her? Because I want my child, and she doesn't want another one." But he didn't have any right to say, because the place wouldn't let him in. And so, unfortunately, this is not just that men are perpetrating this issue, putting the complete burden on women, but they're also being kicked out of the decision-making process. And so that's, you know, that's hard, because you got men that do want to raise their kids, even if it means they're going to be a single dad. A lot of times women will say, "Well, you're a man, so you have no say in the situation, right? You're a guy, you have no right to voice anything about reproductive issues." But arguments don't have gender. So if a man can make a good argument for why abortion is not accurate, or why abortion shouldn't be done, then it shouldn't be held against him that he's a man, because the arguments don't have gender. They're true or false regardless if they're made by a man or a woman. Okay, history. What does history have to say about abortion? So we look at the group that's the most vocal about abortion today, and it's what? Feminists, right? The crazy feminazi women march nut jobs. Okay, I'll be a little bit nicer. women, the hard thing is that, you know, like, I'm a feminist. I'm very vocal about the fact that I think that women should be given more opportunity, they should be paid as much as men, and all. I'm very strongly a feminist in that aspect. I'm not the kind of feminist that goes marching in the Women's March, because that was not a march for women's rights. That was a pro-abortion march. It was very clearly just to promote abortion, and it had nothing to do with women and giving women more rights. I mean, we already have all the rights that we need. We just sometimes need to be treated like that. You know, in history, the crazy thing is that feminists were not pro-abortion. Feminists were actually pro-life in history. Susan B. Anthony, who she's constantly turned to as a uber feminist, and she says, "I deplore the horrible crime of child murder. No matter what the motive, whether it's love of ease or a desire to save from suffering the unborn innocent, the woman is awfully guilty who commits the deed. But oh, thrice guilty is he who drove her to the desperation which impelled her to the crime." Anthony also states that she considers abortion as part of the monstrous evil of society. So Susan B. Anthony was against abortion, and she's considered a very strong feminist leader. Alice Paul, she drafted the original version of the Equal Rights Amendment. She referred to abortion as the ultimate exploitation of women and referred to it as the killing of unborn women. So that's something they don't think about. Half the people that you are aborting or killing are women. Where are their rights? You're marching for women's rights, but where are the little girls' rights? Where, you know, I don't understand. Sarah Norton, who challenged Cornell University to admit women, wrote that she looked forward to a day when the right of the unborn to be born will not be denied or interfered with. Everyone has a right to live, and everyone has a right to be born, right? And you can be feminist and believe that. Judith Blake said she was a person who basically charted abortion in public opinion in the 1960s and 70s. And she said that legalized abortion is supported and most strongly by the non-Catholic, obviously, male, well-educated establishment, and upper-class men have much to gain and very little to lose by an easing of the legal restrictions against abortion. So Roe v. Wade was not really pro-woman. It was really more for the convenience of men, and men are the ones who kind of made that decision based on what was happening in the sexual revolution at the time. And the woman who is in Roe v. Wade, she actually recently passed away, but she was upset because later on she changed her mind, and she decided that she was actually pro-life, and so she tried for years to overturn the law that held her name, but she wasn't able to do so. So history tells us that abortion is not supported by feminists, and should not be supported by feminists today, because it's attacking and killing unborn women. and it's also exploiting women for the cause of men. So, lastly, the Bible. What does the Bible say about abortion? So the first few work great with people who are not Christians, but you still have the Christians who are like, I'm still going to get abortion. And sometimes you can maybe appeal to their Christian or a theological side in order to convince them not to. So what does the Bible say about abortion? First, we'll specifically cover what does the Bible say about the sanctity of human life. First, remain in the image of God, right? Then God said, let us make man in our image according to our likeness. He created them male and female. Genesis 9:6, whoever sheds human blood, by humans their blood shall be shed, because in the image of God has God made mankind. The reason the death penalty is a thing is because if you kill somebody, you're attacking God, because God's image is in 1 Corinthians 3:16, don't you know that you yourselves are God's temple and God's spirit dwells in your midst? If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy that person. For God's temple is sacred and you together are that temple. Two, we're created with purpose. So not only are we created in the image of God, but guess what? We have purpose beyond just being born. There's a whole plan for our lives. You're tampering with God's will when you snuff somebody's life out. Psalm 22:10 says, I was cast upon you from birth. From my mother's womb, you have been my God. From my mother's womb, you have been my God. I'm speaking from the womb there. Isaiah 49:1, the Lord has called me from the womb. From the matrix of my mother, he has made mention of my name. So Isaiah was called before he was even born. Jeremiah 1, then the word of the Lord came to me, saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I sanctified you. I ordained you as a prophet to the nations. Jeremiah was called to be a prophet before he was even born. Galatians 1:15, but when it pleased God, who separated me, from my mother's womb and called me through his grace. Apostle Paul, talking about God, who separated him from his mother's womb and called him through his grace. So, number one, humans are sacred, and number two, we're created with purpose. Psalm 139:13-16. This is probably one of the most pro-life passages in the Bible. We'll go through each one real quick. Verse 13, it says, for thou hast possessed my reins, you have covered me in my mother's womb. It's interesting wording. This is a KJV. I feel like it's a great version of this, because the word for covered here is sakak. It's S-A-K-A-K. In the Hebrew. And it means to fence in, cover over, protect, defend, and hedge in. Obviously, God wants to keep that baby where it is, right? And it says, for thou hast possessed my reins. The word for possessed is kana. And kana actually means to erect, to create, to procure, and to purchase. It implies ownership by attaining or buying. So that's interesting, because it says, for God has possessed my reins. God has possessed me in my mother's womb. He not only has created, which is what that word means, but it also means he purchased. So God owns us twice. And so it's not ours to mess with. Verse 14, I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and my soul knows that well. My substance was not hid from you. I was made in the secret and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. I love this verse because the word for wrought is rakam. And that word, actually, when you talk about being curiously wrought, it means to vary a great color, which is similar to what an embroiderer would do. So it's the idea of the embryo being an embroidery that an embroiderer would design. And so it's the fact that there is design to the fetus. So if there's design, what, there's a designer, right? Verse 16 says, So verse 16 says, thine eyes did see my substance, yet being imperfect, and in thy book all my members were written, which in countenance were fashioned when as yet there was none of them. So here's the best way to determine if an embryo is a person, right? At this point, God has said, all his members are written, all his days are planned, his eyes are on this. But the Hebrew word for imperfect is golem. I don't mean like golem from Lord of the Rings, but golem. And golem means a wrapped and unformed mass, a substance yet being unperfect. So God knows the hair on the head of every single unformed and imperfect mass in the womb. And he has their life already planned. So the Hebrew is very clear here what's being talked about and how serious it is. So not only are humans sanctified because they're made in the image of God and God has a plan for them, but also humans are sanctified because we have a responsibility to preserve them. So, what does the Bible say is our responsibility as humans regarding abortion? Did you know that over 3,500 babies are aborted every single day in the U.S.? That's more than two a minute. Probably more because they're not open at night. So it might even be twice that. So it's probably more than four a minute. It's every 30 seconds, but four a minute during the day, let's say, during business hours. So if that's happening, obviously, God just doesn't want us to sit on our butts and do nothing, right? So what are we supposed to do? Proverbs 24:10-12 says, if you falter in time of trouble, how small is your strength? Rescue those being led away to death. Hold back those staggering towards slaughter. If you say, but we knew nothing about this, does not he who weighs the heart perceive it? Does not he who guards your life know it? Will he not repay everyone according to what they have done? So my whole thing is when I speak on this in front of large audiences, I give them that stat and I say, now you can't say you didn't know. And now you've got a responsibility to do something about it. Because guess what? You can't fool God. You can't say I didn't know. Because does not he who weigh the heart perceive it? Does not he who guard the life know it? And so we have a responsibility because of that, because of what God has charged us to do. Deuteronomy 30:19, I call heaven and earth to record this day against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life that both you and your seed may live. Not only is it a responsibility for us to tell other people about abortion and to not do it, but guess what? There's an individual calling to women. Choose life so that you and your seed may live, right? So you have life and death as a choice, blessing and cursing, but he's telling them to choose life. So in conclusion, many reasons why you should hold an anti-abortion position philosophically, logically, scientifically, and medically, psychologically, historically, and biblically. There's lots of good reasons for being anti-abortion. And for people to say that it's not a logical position or a medical position to hold, that's just simply not true.